Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host, and maybe you get used to Jimmy Akin on a Friday now, and Joe on a Wednesday, and Dr. Carla Broussard on a Tuesday. We do that on purpose. We want you to have it to be predictable, but this week we couldn't predict the weather, and snow has kept Dr. Broussard off the air. Jimmy Akin here with us for this Tuesday afternoon or evening, depending on where you are. And if you would like to ask a question, you are welcome to call 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. We'll do our very best to get you on with Jimmy. And there are two lines open right now. We got six on this phone, and two of them are open right now. So go ahead and dial. We will start out this hour.
So all this Dr. Carlo Broussard stuff.
Yeah.
Now, I grew up in an academic family, and Carlo has an earned doctorate, and that means something. I don't use the title doctor for people who have fake doctorates, like James White, for example. But I've known Carlo for years, and he's always been Carlo to me.
I know, it's hard.
And so if you're going to be doctor in him, I may insist on my title. I am Mr., which is, of course, a form of master.
Okay.
So you're going to need to start calling me Master Jimmy.
Oh, my God. I'm not doing that. So like, Carlo, like I'm on a, Carlo like can
I'm
lose.
On a, like I'm on the Jedi Council or something.
Okay. All right. All right. Well, that's not happening. I won't be able to keep straight all of you. So Dr. Broussard is just going back to Carlo if there's an ultimatum. All right. Let's go.
I'm just kidding around.
I know you are. Let's go to Leslie in New Orleans, Louisiana, listening on 690 AM. Leslie, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Master Jimmy Akin.
That meant to be. I'm trying.
Leslie, are you with us?
Hi.
Hi.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Yes. This is Leslie, yes. Oh,
well, you are on the air with Jimmy Akin. No, it's all right.
Hey, Jimmy. I'm sorry. I'm right outside of church. I'm right outside of mass. So I'm just...
That's okay. What's your question, Leslie?
The phrase, agree to disagree. When you are in debate or when I'm in discussion with someone about our faith, they're actually fallen away Catholics, and they'll say something in opposition to the church, and that's why they're quote-unquote not Catholic anymore. And then I explain to them or debate a particular thing. And, you know, just maybe after the first comment I make, they'll just automatically say, well, we're going to agree to disagree. Like, just they come right out and say, this is what we're going to do. How do I respond to that? I don't feel comfortable with agreeing to that.
Well, so what that phrase is used to do is be a conversation stopper. And so if someone says, we'll have to agree to disagree. Now, if they say it like, we're going to agree to disagree, then I'd say they're being a jerk. Because they're posing it in an overly aggressive form. And you have a judgment call at that point. Do you want to respond in kind? Because you can be snarky back and say, oh, is that what we're going to do? Which points out to them that they were just a jerk. Well, there's a judgment call there. As the book of Proverbs says, answer a fool according to his folly. And as the book of Proverbs also says, answer not a fool according to his folly. It has that's two verses that are right next to each other in the book of Proverbs. And what that tells us is there's a judgment call to be made. When someone's being a jerk, you sometimes respond in kind and you sometimes don't. And you have to use judgment to figure out which is the case. So if someone, you know, aggressively says, well, we're going to agree to disagree, I'd say, oh, is that what we're going to do? That's an option for you. On the other hand, you may turn the other cheek, and it may be more to your benefit to help the person to respond in a kind way where you're not being a jerk to them. So that's a judgment call you have to think about. On the other hand, if the person uses this phrase, but it's not in a hostile way, you know, if they said, well, I'm not Catholic because of X, and you then say, oh, well, here's a Catholic perspective on that. And they've heard you out. So they're, you know, they're listening to you, they're being polite. And then they say, well, at some point, well, I'm afraid we're going to have to agree to disagree. And they say it in a kind way. Well, I wouldn't be a jerk to them. I would take that as, okay, they're telling me that they don't want to talk about this more right now. And if I press the matter further, it's not going to be productive. You know, they're already telling me they don't want to keep going on this conversation, and it'll be counterproductive if I keep pushing it. Well, again, there's a judgment call of do I keep pushing it or not? But ordinarily, if they're being polite, then I would not push it. You know, if they say, no, I'm afraid we're going to have to disagree, I'd say, okay, you know, and if you ever want to talk about this more in the future, I'd be more than happy to, and leave it at that. Because there are situations where it's just not practical to keep going on a conversation. And, you know, Catholics too can be in situations where they need to say, oh, I'm afraid we'll have to agree to disagree, because it's just not practical to go on with the conversation right now. It's not being productive. And so I don't think this is really a Catholic versus non-Catholic issue. I think people can, whether they're Catholic or non-Catholic, can be a jerk when they use the phrase, or they can use it as a polite way of getting out of a conversation that doesn't seem to be productive anymore. So there are judgment calls to be made and how to respond. But in general, if they're being polite, I would be graceful in accepting their request not to continue the conversation for now.
Okay, Leslie.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. Thanks for the call and for the question. Wendy's in Wisconsin listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Wendy, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, thank you for being on the radio. I love your program.
Thank you.
My question, I think, is going to be really easy for Jimmy. I have a few friends who have sought the advice or the interaction with a medium. And I know that our catechism says this is not appropriate. We should not be doing this as Catholics. And some of these people are. How do I kindly remind them or show them the difference between that and doing like prophetic messages and those kind of things?
Well, okay, if in terms of reminding them, it is pretty easy. The catechism addresses this subject in paragraph 2117. And so I would, if you just want to remind people, I would say, you know, I understand you've been talking to a medium, and you should be aware that the catechism, expresses concerns about that. And it's in paragraph 2117. You can either give them the number of the paragraph, or you could even read it with them. But reminding them is pretty easy. In terms of explaining the reasoning behind what the catechism says, well, you have to read the passage, and you have to read it carefully, because the catechism is phrased pretty carefully. In the case of mediumship, it doesn't actually use the term medium. It uses the related term spiritism, which is the practice of mediumship. It's another word for the practice of mediumship. And it says, in part, in paragraph 2117, that spiritism often implies divination, or which is learning about the future through unethical means, or magical practices. And so so the catechism says spiritism often implies divination or magical practices. The church, for her part, warns the faithful against it. And that's what the catechism has to say. So the church warns people against spiritism or mediumship on two grounds. The first ground is that it often implies divination or learning about the future through unethical means, and it often implies magical practices. And so those are the two reasons that the Catechism cites as the reasons for the church's warning against it. I would actually add a third reason against it, which is this is not true of all mediums, but many mediums are fake. They may realize they're fake and that they're consciously swindling people out of money, especially in times of grief when they, you know, have a lost loved one they want to talk to, and the medium will use a combination of what are known as cold reading and hot reading to convince the person that they are in communication with their lost loved one when in fact they're not. And sometimes they will be innocently unaware of what they're doing. They may, the medium may be committing fraud without even realizing it. They may think they're in contact with a departed loved one, but really they're unconsciously cold reading the person that they're talking to. And they're using this cold reading technique without even being aware of it. And I know of mediums who have looked back on their career as a medium and say, yeah, I was really cold reading people. Cold reading is when you deduce things based on who you're talking to. Like you look at their age and their gender and their ethnicity and their clothing and, you know, things like that. And you deduce things about who their lost loved one may be. And then you ask them questions and get confirmation on some things, but not others. And that kind of guides them through the reading process. Hot reading, and you can do cold reading unconsciously. We all cold read each other all the time without thinking about it. Hot reading is when you deliberately research a person for purposes of fraud. So hot reading, like if you go on someone's Facebook page and look up material about them that you can then use to fake a reading with their loved one, that's always conscious fraud. But cold reading can be unconscious. And some mediums have looked back and said, yeah, I was just cold reading people. I don't think I was really in touch with their relatives. So in addition to the divination and the magical practices, I would say there's also a significant risk of fraud. This is something that was investigated quite thoroughly by scientists back in the late 1800s and early 1900s with, for example, the Society for Psychical Research in Great Britain and the American Society for Psychical Research here in America, where they looked into all different kinds of mediums and they found that a lot of them are consciously or unconsciously committing fraud, although they did find some seeming exceptions. So I would say that in terms of what the Catechism says, it warns people against mediumship because it often involves divination. It warns people against mediumship because it often involves magical practices. And I would say it also could warn people against mediumship on the ground that that it often involves fraud. Now, someone could come back and say, well, I'm not using it for divination and I'm not using it for magic and I have confidence that my medium is not a fraud. I have evidence why I think they're not a fraud. Is it okay then? And that's a subject that actually the Catechism doesn't address. The issue is complicated here because there are some forms of communication with the dead that are perfectly legitimate. Like if a saint shows up in an apparition, well, you can talk to the saint, and even more generally, you know, the Book of John says, test the spirits to see whether they're of God. The only way to test them is to talk to them. So if a spirit shows up and takes the initiative, if it's an after-death communication or an apparition or something like that, well, then you can talk to them. So there's a line here that the church has not precisely defined, at least not as of yet. So the church warns people against mediumship, but it hadn't yet answered every conceivable question in this area.
I'll tell you what, I'm going to leave it there, Wendy. I hope that was what you were looking for. I hope that was helpful to you, but we got to take the break. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's Ask Me Anything on Catholic Answers Live.
Your questions, Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
This is Jim Pinto, director of EWTN Media Missionaries. Mother Angelica said, "The essence of evangelization is to tell everybody Jesus loves you. You can help EWTN share the good news by becoming a media missionary. Visit EWTNmissionaries.com today and join us in sharing the eternal word with the world.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's Ask Me Anything. All the lines full. Lots of great questions to come. Jimmy, you wanted to just add something about what you said to Wendy before we went back to the phones, though.
Yeah, this is just an illustration of how there are some questions that the church hadn't clearly settled yet in this area. There was a reply in the first half of the 20th century that was issued by the then Holy Office. It's now the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. A dubium or doubt or question was submitted by a bishop about a gentleman who was referred to by the privacy name Titius. Titius is a Latin man's name. And the bishop wrote in and he said, here's what Titius is doing. While excluding all occult purpose from what he's doing, he'll sit down and he'll have a question about a set of questions for a loved one that has passed on, you know, not necessarily his loved one, but someone's loved one. And he prays to God to allow him to have contact with that spirit. And then he takes a pen in his hand and he lets his hand write the answers to the questions he has. And he's excluding all purpose of you know, any evil influence or any evil spirit. He doesn't want to talk to them. And the answers he gets back are all fully orthodox, and they're all in consonance with what you would expect from a departed Catholic spirit, saying things like, for example, my relatives need to have another mass said for me, or they need to pray for me more, or things like that. And so it's all orthodox answers. Is it okay for Titius to do this? And now this is normally when today it's the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith. Normally when they answer a question like this from a bishop, they answer with a one-word reply. They say either affirmative, meaning the answer is yes, or they say negative, meaning the answer is no. And they do that over and over and over again. And so anytime they say anything other than affirmative or negative, it's significant. Now, this is the early 20th century, and this is the pre-Vatican II Holy Office. And so what do they say when they're asked about Titius using automatic writing to contact the spirits of departed loved ones? They don't say affirmative, and they don't say negative. They come back and they say, not in the circumstances described. And that would suggest, so it's not a clear yes, it's not a clear no. That's an example of how the magisterium has not settled every question in this area. And the way they phrased it, not in the circumstances described, could suggest that this might be okay in some other circumstances. They don't say what those might be, but it does envision the possibility. So I'm being real careful here in trying to stick close to the texts of what the Catechism and what other church documents have actually said here, and point out that although there are clear warnings, you know, there's often divination, there's often magic, and I would add there's often fraud. There are some areas that there's some gray zone that the church hasn't fully clarified yet.
Michael, up next. Michael's in Michigan watching on YouTube. Michael, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Good, thank you.
So my question is, were the Jewish people in the first century expecting a divine Messiah? And to kind of add to that, how can I show Jewish people that a divine Messiah isn't contrary to Judaism?
Okay. So the Jewish people in the time of Christ definitely were expecting a Messiah. The question is, what kind of Messiah? would the Messiah be a heavenly figure like the Son of God, or would he just be an earthly human figure, a purely human Messiah? And the answer is that there were different opinions on this. In some traditions, the Messiah or Son of Man, to use a parallel term, was envisioned as an ordinary human. But in other traditions, the Messiah was envisioned as a heavenly celestial figure. So it really depends on which group of first century Jews you're talking about. Some had an expectation for one kind of Messiah. Some had an expectation for another kind of Messiah. Some didn't know what the Messiah was going to be. When it comes to showing that a concept of a divine Messiah is not inconsistent with the Jewish faith, there are various passages that are suggestive of a celestial Son of Man, a celestial Messiah figure. One of those is in the book of Daniel, where Daniel has a vision of God in heaven. He refers to him here as the Ancient of Days, and he sees God seated on his throne in heaven in the clouds, and he's surrounded by his heavenly court, which is also seated on thrones. And then Daniel says, and up to God came one like a Son of Man riding on a cloud. And this is the basis for Jesus' own self-description of himself as the Son of Man. Now, in later Judaism, this Son of Man-like figure was interpreted in other ways. But in first century Judaism at the time of Christ and for a few centuries thereabout, it was often understood as the Son of Man was understood as a celestial figure, because he's not coming from earth. He's already riding on clouds, and riding on clouds is what God gets to do. And so there were Jews who looked at this figure and said, okay, this is some kind of divine figure. It's like a second Yahweh or a lesser Yahweh. And so the idea that there is more than one divine figure in heaven, and also the nations end up worshiping this Son of Man. So the idea that there's more than one heavenly figure that is deserving of worship became known in some Jewish circles, and at least this is the name that's applied to it today, as the two powers in heaven doctrine. And it's to this that Jesus refers when he's put on trial in front of the Sanhedrin, the Jewish ruling council, in the Gospel of Mark. The high priest tells Jesus at one point, you know, tell us plainly, are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed, meaning the Son of God? And he says, yes, and from now on, you're going to see the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. And he's directly invoking Daniel's vision and applying it to himself. He's saying, I'm that dude. I'm the second Yahweh. I'm the second power in heaven. And it's at that point that the high priest, he knows what he's saying. He tears his robes and says, you've heard the blasphemy. Why do we need any more witnesses? Well, it wasn't blasphemy to claim to be a human Messiah, to just be a son of David who was going to kick out the Romans and stuff. That's not blasphemy. That's prophecy. But in the high priest's eyes, he was not a believer in the two powers in heaven doctrine. And so he thought Jesus's endorsement of the two powers in heaven doctrine was a blasphemy. But not all Jews from this period agreed with the high priest. There were Jews who did believe in the two powers in heaven doctrine. And so consequently, this is a strand in Jewish intellectual history, and thus the idea of a heavenly divine Messiah is not, this is one illustration of how a heavenly divine Messiah is consistent with certain Jewish understandings of the Messiah, although it's not all Jewish understandings of the Messiah. If you'd like more information about that, I would suggest going to schoolofapologetics.com, where I have a course called Evidence for Jesus, where I go through the different strands of Jewish interpretation of the Messiah and document them for you so you can see the source documents that they're coming from and have a deeper understanding of them.
Okay, Michael?
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. Thanks very much, Michael. The number here, 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's Ask Me Anything. If you've got a question you'd like to ask Jimmy, you are welcome to. You probably go to the top of the line if you say Master Jimmy Akin. That's the title he's going by today. Anyone is welcome. Anyone's welcome to ask their question. We're going to take a very quick break. Before we do, I'll remind you that all this year, throughout the entire year, anybody who joins Society 315 here at Catholic Answers receives the Halo app and all kinds of wonderful stuff there on the Halo app, and we'd love you to have it. All you have to do is go to casociety315.com. You could also just search the internet, Catholic Answers Society 315. When you become a member, we'd be delighted to give you a full year of the Halo app. And we're delighted that we're among those who have materials there on the Halo app available for you, but there's just an endless supply of wonderful stuff there, help you with your prayer and help you with your Catholic life. Just go to CASociety315 and sign up. Jimmy Akin, our guest. He's the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Maybe you got a mystery you want to ask him about. Maybe you got something else you want to ask him about. It's all welcome, and we'll continue with it right after this on Catholic Answers Live. The word discipleship is often abused, and many Catholics are not even sure it applies to them. Well, it does, and in his new book, Real Discipleship, best-selling author Father Jeffrey Kirby helps you to separate true discipleship from false. A lively mix of theology, history, Bible study, and common sense, Real Discipleship is for anyone who wants to follow Jesus closely. Order your copy of Real Discipleship today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore.
When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
What was the church like in its infancy? In a word, Catholic. And Joe Heschmeyer has the receipts. In his best-selling book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, he gives you the details from the historical records of the first two centuries of Christianity. Right now, get a copy for just $10, plus free shipping if you live in the continental United States. Get more information and order The Early Church Was the Catholic Church at theearlychurchwascatholic.com.
Why do Catholics pray to dead people, bow to statues, venerate relics? And where do we find any of this stuff in the Bible? In the delightful book, The Saints Pray for You, Dr. Carlo Broussard convincingly defends the ancient Christian belief rooted in Scripture that the saints care for us, that they are allies. Order your copy of The Saints Pray for You today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
On the next More to Life, no go.
When is enough enough? We'll help you set better boundaries.
That's on the next More to Life. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour. And it's an Ask Me Anything, and all the lines are full. All of those things add up to me just going back to the phone. So here we go to Tom in Colorado Springs, Colorado, watching on YouTube. We're glad you're here, Tom. Go ahead with your question.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This is for Jimmy directly. Yeah. I'm going through a divorce right now. It's not my choice to do this. Yeah, I know. I married my wife about 5 years ago. We have two beautiful kids. Mm-hmm. And like I said, it's not my choice. It's her choice. We're both practicing Catholics before we met, during our engagement, during dating, and after we got married, too. To my knowledge, she is still a practicing Catholic, too, and yet she is seeking a divorce. I do understand that the Catholic Church allows one to seek a civil divorce for various reasons. I do not think that our marriage meets any of those reasons at all. And I guess since I don't want one because I believe in the validity of my sacrament and her promise to it and my promise to it, and the covenant that we entered. I don't really understand why I can't ask the church to intervene well before we get to the annulment process. Mm-hmm. I do not believe this marriage is annulable. And I guess I'm also a little concerned that even when we get to the annulment, if we get there in the first place, that I'm not really going to get a good defense at that, because to my understanding, there's a lot of vague interpretations of canon law these days. I don't know why I can't go to a church authority and say, hey, this is happening to me. Can you step in here and defend the sacrament instead of waiting to the annulment process? Yeah.
You can't do that.
Tell me that the bishops won't do that for me. I don't know if that's true or not, but the bishops are very hesitant to do that for me.
Well, so have you actually asked this question?
I've asked it to the priest in my diocese close to the bishop.
Okay.
And they said it's very unlikely that the bishop will help me with that.
Yeah. Do you personally know the bishop?
I don't, but I don't understand why that's a quality. Shouldn't the bishop, like, isn't that a canon law thing that they're kind of bound to? I'm not quite sure if it is or not, but isn't that a canon law thing that they're bound to advocate for that sacrament?
Well, they're bound to uphold the integrity of the sacrament when it's challenged, but that's different than providing marital counseling. You know, I mean, if you think about what would be involved in this. Now, I'm not making excuses here. I'm just explaining as best I can the human reality of the situation. The bishop, I gather, does not know you, does not know your wife. He doesn't know your backgrounds. Now, you can brief him on that, but he would have to come up to speed on your individual situation and form his own judgment about it, which might or might not agree with yours. He might agree with your wife.
Right.
But you're asking him to invest time. Now, it's reasonable for the faithful in a diocese to expect their bishop to invest some reasonable amount of time in them as individuals, but the more people he has under his care, the less that amount of time is going to be. And, you know, if he's got thousands of people in his diocese, and you think about how many of those people are likely to get divorces over the course of their lives, he may have so many people that if he tried to do this for everybody, he would do nothing else but this, you know, which would then deprive him of the office of functioning as a bishop. He's got other things he needs to do as a bishop, not just investigating marriage situations personally and providing counseling and stuff like that. Typically, I would expect not a bishop to do this function, but a priest, you know, especially the pastor of the two people who would presumably know them better and not require the extreme learning curve that a bishop would require. Even then, a lot of parishes are ginormous and the pastor may not know everybody personally. So I think similar considerations could apply to a pastor. If I were in the situation, by the way, I meant to say, I'm very sorry to hear about this and I'll definitely be praying for it. And I'd encourage other, you know, the listeners to pray for the situation as well, both for you and your wife and for everybody who's in similar situations, because these are painful situations. Having said that, if I were in such a situation and wanted to try to get some church intervention, I would approach my pastor, not the bishop. Even then, though, I would do so not with an expectation of course, this is going to happen, because it may not be reasonable for the pastor either. In addition to the coming up to speed problem and forming a judgment problem as an outsider, there's another factor complicating the situation too, which is that if both parties were saying, we want to work this out and we just need some counseling to help us work this out or help us see if we can work it out, well, I would say the priest still might refer you to a professional marriage counselor. But I would think the odds would be greater that a priest, either personally or through an assistant, like an associate pastor or a deacon, might try to help out in that situation. But if one party is unwilling, I think the odds of ecclesiastical or church intervention go down, because the church has to care for everybody involved in this situation. And that means not taking sides, because if the there's you and your wife and your two children, okay, let's suppose the church came into this situation and took your side and said, you guys need to stay together, and your wife is unwilling to do so. They would just alienate the church. They would alienate your wife from the church if they came down hard and said, you need to stay together, and your wife was unwilling to do that for whatever reason. They just alienated her. And if she gets custody of those kids, or to the extent she gets effective custody of them, even if she doesn't have it all the time, it would also potentially alienate those children from the church. On the other hand, let's suppose that the church came into the situation and intervened and said, your wife is right, you guys should break up. Well, that would alienate you from the church. And to the extent that you have custody or effective custody of the children, it could also alienate the children from the church. And so in order to do the most good to the most souls, the church largely needs to remain neutral with respect to disputes of this nature, and let the parties, you know, assist the parties when they ask for help. So like if you asked for your pastor's prayers, you asked him to give you some counseling or help you find a counselor, I'm sure he'd be happy to do that. But when you're talking about the church intervening directly in the situation and trying to achieve a particular outcome that is not desired by one of the participants, the church is going to have a much harder time intervening, because it needs to look to the long-term good of all of the souls involved and try not to alienate any of them from the church. So between the learning curve issue and the alienation issue, I can understand why a bishop or a pastor would say, given that, you know, the parties are not all wanting to make this work out, I think we need to step back from this and keep it in prayer and offer what assistance we can that is desired by the parties, but not try to force a situation, not try to force assistance on someone who doesn't want it. And so that's how I would tend to look at the situation. I hope that's helpful, Tom. And like I said, it's a really tough situation. I will be praying for it, and I encourage others to pray for it as well.
Thank you, Tom. We'll take a break. Right back with more Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
In Morse code, the sequence SOS is a distress call. It's been said that it stands for Save Our Souls. Well, right now, our world is in big trouble, and we're putting out an SOS call for help. Will you answer that call? St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, has hundreds of teams who share the good news with souls who don't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to get involved.
This is Father Gerald Murray. Catholic truth conveyed through the radio reaches so many, both Catholic and non-Catholic, and they receive encouragement, strength, guidance, and enlightenment. The Holy Spirit is working through these radio waves that go out to all the countries of the world. Catholic radio, of course, is an effort to make Christ known.
The world needs EWTN Catholic Radio, now more than ever.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest. And as you would expect with Jimmy here, lines have stayed full. So lots of calls to get to still. It's Ask Me Anything. Michael is in San Antonio, Texas, listening on the Guadalupe Radio Network. Michael, go ahead with your question for Jimmy Akin.
Thank you all for taking my call.
Sure.
So is animal predation a consequence of original sin?
Well, the church has no teaching on this, so there is a difference of opinion. Some individuals think that when mankind fell, that it affected the physical, the natural world, such that animals that were not predators became predators. Prior to the fall, or in the absence of the fall, they would have been vegetarians on this view. Some, like Hans Urs von Balthasar, would propose that, well, there never was a time when animals weren't predators, but they are still predators because of the fall. So, like, the human race fell, and that had kind of an effect on our whole timeline, so that even though there was never a time when animals were not predators, like, you know, we see from dinosaurs predating each other and stuff, that it's still because of the fall. On the other hand, there is another opinion, which is advocated, among others, by St. Thomas Aquinas. And I'm not a Thomist, but I agree with St. Thomas here. The nature of animals did not change because of the fall. So in Aquinas's view, those animals which are predators were always predators and would have been predators even if man had never fallen, because there is what Genesis says is that human death entered the world through the fall. It doesn't say anything about animal death. And so, you know, in Aquinas's view, lions did not used to eat straw like oxen. Lions were always obligate carnivores the way they are now. And the more we've learned about the biology of lions, which are obligate carnivores, they have to eat meat. They can't eat anything but meat, except in maybe very small quantities. The more we've learned about their biology, they are just configured to eat meat. They do not have the physical systems that oxen do that would allow them to eat plants. And so they basically wouldn't be lions if you reconfigured their biology to be herbivores. So I agree with St. Thomas Aquinas. Those animals that are predators were always predators, and their nature did not change because of the fall. But that is my opinion. Other people have other opinions.
And I am going to leave that there, Michael, because I would like to try to get as many on as I can before we have to end. Jimmy Akin, our guest. John's in Dallas, Texas, watching on YouTube. Glad you're here, John. Go ahead with your question.
Yes, I just have a question on scripture currently. Mm-hmm. I'm reading about the 12 tribes and, you know, currently how the U.S. is always wanting to protect Israel. Is that specific tribe Judah out there currently? And should we feel the need to protect them?
Okay, so in regard to the first question, the identities of the Jewish tribes has largely been lost in history. What we can say with reasonable confidence is that there are certain tribal affiliations that can be identified in a probabilistic way. So, for example, if someone identifies as a Jew, and they and by the way, this has nothing to do with biology, or not nothing, but it's not strictly tied to biology, because you could become a Jew in the ancient world by conversion. And, you know, you could convert and join one of the tribes, and they would retroactively adopt you into the line of the tribe. So you would become a member of the tribe of Judah, even if you were born an Egyptian or a Roman or whatever else. So don't think of this in terms of genes being passed down. It's a religious ethnic identity that is passed down through more than just genetic means. So having said that, most Jews today are descendants legally, biologically, or at least legally, of the tribe of Judah. However, mixed in with those that are biologically the descendants of the tribe of Judah, there also are Jews that would be descendants of the tribe of Simeon, because Judah absorbed the tribe of Simeon early on. And also there will be Jews who are descendants of the tribe of Benjamin, because the distinction between Judahites and Benjaminites later got lost. However, within the group of people who identify as Jews, there are also some who appear to have maintained an identity indicating that they are not descendants of Judah or Simeon or Benjamin, but Levi. Traditionally, it is regarded that if a Jewish person has a last name like Levi or Levit, that they are descendants of the tribe of Levi. Also, if they have a last name like Cohen, which is the Hebrew word for priest, Kohen, then they are also a descendant of the tribe of Levi, because they the priests were all members of the tribe of Levi. So if someone's a priest, they're automatically a Levite. Then in Galilee, we have the Samaritans, and the Samaritans are descendants not of Judah, but of the northern tribes, most particularly the tribe of Ephraim. And so there's some Ephraimite tribal identity that is maintained as well. But broadly speaking, the distinction between the tribes has been lost, except for the things I just named. So that should hopefully answer your first question, John. Your second question was, do we have to support them? Well, no. You don't have to support people just because of who their ancestors were. Now, we want to pray for our Jewish brethren, and it may be advisable, even beneficial, to do what we can to help them out in a wide variety of situations. As God told Abraham, I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse those who curse you. So there can be benefits to helping out the Jewish people. Having said that, that does not mean that that they have a right to their current nation state. That's something Catholics can have different opinions on. Also, it doesn't mean we have to advocate or support Israel in any particular policy that they choose to adopt. The policy may be good, the policy may be bad. And if it's good, it's good to support it. If it's bad, it's good not to support it. So we can't get out of the difficult process of making practical historical decisions about morality and adopt a help the Jews every single time, no exceptions, Israel, love it or leave it, or a reject and harm the Jews in every situation. We have to use discernment and moral judgment to figure out what are good policies, what are bad policies, what's possible, what's not possible, and try to achieve the most good that's possible.
Again, I'm going to leave it there. I'm going to keep trying to get folks on with Jimmy, but thank you very much, John, for the question. This is Blaze right here in El Cajon, California, watching on YouTube. Blaze, welcome. Go ahead with your question.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was calling because my fiance is in RCIA right now, and she was baptized as a Protestant, so she's making her profession of faith. But I was just wondering if there's any urgency for her to go to confession, because they told us that she could go to confession now, but if she did, she wouldn't receive absolution. And I was kind of confused when they told me that. And I guess the plan is for them to go during the Lenten service, because she does need some absolution before she receives confirmation, is my understanding.
Yep.
Since she's not being baptized.
Okay, I would be at a loss to explain what they told you. If one is not going to confession if there's not an absolution. One might, voluntarily go and say, just as an exercise in accountability or, therapy, one might go and say, well, I did this and I did this and I'm trying to struggle to overcome this. But that's not confession if there's no absolution. If there's no absolution, it is not the sacrament of confession. It's something else. So at a minimum, I would say if they said she can go to confession but she can't be absolved, they are confused. Because what it sounds like to me is they're expecting to have candidates for reception into the church go to confession closer to the time of their reception, and they do need to do that. If you know, if they've never been to confession and they have committed any mortal sins in their life, they need to get right on those before they're confirmed, and before they receive the Eucharist for the first time. So that does need to happen. And they may have just, as a parish, adopted a policy of, we do this closer to the time of reception. However, and this is Canon 844 in the Code of Canon Law. If you want to look it up, it's online. But in Canon 844, the Code of Canon Law, it specifies that those who are Protestant, like your, I think, fiancé, you said,
yes,
those who are Protestant are able to receive three sacraments, confession, the anointing of the sick, and the Eucharist, if there is danger of death or other grave necessity, and they ask for it on their own and so forth. So if your girlfriend or your fiance found it difficult to remain in sin, like if it was a burden on her, I mean, it was, God forbid she gets into danger or death, but assuming she doesn't get into danger or death, if it was a burden on her to not go to confession until closer to time of reception, she could go to confession now under the provisions of Canon 844 as a Protestant. She could say, look, it's really a burden for me to be able to not be absolved. I really want to be absolved faster. And so I'd like to go to confession now under these provisions of Canon 844.
I'm going to, again, leave that there and try to get as many on as I can before we have to go. That means heading up to Nebraska, where Ken is listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. Ken, if you could be quick with your question, we could probably get you an answer.
Okay. I'm basically a new Catholic. I came in about 5 years ago.
Okay.
And the one thing I have trouble understanding is during the Mass, just before we say the Our Father, the priest uses the phrase, "We dare to say." And I've always wondered, why do we dare to say the Our Father? My question.
Well, so that's what the English translation in front of the priest says he's supposed to say. And I'd have to look up the Latin to see, is there a special nuance to the word that may not be captured in the English translation? But just taking the English translation for what it is, I would say that that essentially we dare to say means we have the confidence to say. There also may be an additional connotation, and this is why I'd want to check the Latin, but there also may be an additional connotation whose function is to highlight our dependence on God's mercy. The idea is not that God's not going to be merciful to us or that we have anything to be afraid of in saying the Our Father, but by saying, you know, we dare to say could be understood to mean we're not actually worthy to talk to God, and it's by His grace that we get to talk to Him. It's by His mercy. There's an act of mercy in God listening to us sinners, because He doesn't have to, but He chooses to because He's merciful. And so by phrasing it in these terms, it's a way of reminding us of just how dependent we are on God's mercy. Now, He is a merciful God. He wants us to pray to Him. He wants us to pray the Our Father to Him. That's why He taught it to us. So we're doing God's will here, but it can be helpful to be reminded of, yeah, we kind of are still sinners and we really are dependent on God's mercy. And so, it's another way of saying we're not worthy, but by God's mercy, we say the Our Father together. So that's how I would interpret the phrase.
And I will leave the interpretation there, Ken. God bless you. Thank you very much for the call. Sorry for those callers we did not get to, but we are coming down to the end. Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World drops each Friday. Each Monday, the Jimmy Akin podcast drops. And so coming up on Friday. So again, this Friday, the one... looking
forward. Part one of USS Hornet.
The USS Hornet. Did you say spooky or suspicious, or how would, what's a good modifier
mysterious.
For
mysterious?
Mysterious. All right. A mysterious episode for Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World coming up on Friday. Hey, thanks very much for being with us. I don't want you to forget, we've got that Fat February book sale. I don't know why it's called Fat February, but it is a Fat February book sale, $10 book sale, more than 100 books, ebooks on sale. Just head over to shop.catholic.com and look for the sale. All kinds of great deals on books. That will do it for us. We will see you tomorrow, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.